right this way, Mr. Eastwood, in honor of The Light Between Oceans, which is probably fine. What's the worst Oscar-ready movie that you've ever seen?
I'm Joanna Robinson. My answer is Australia by Baz Luhrmann.
The highest grossing movie of all time in Australia, by the way.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with J.A. Boyona's Bayona, I think that's how you pronounce the last name, The Impossible, which is to this day one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. And while I am cautiously optimistic for a Monster Calls, I will go out of my way. I will set up a Twitter search just to make sure that anyone who tweets positively about this man knows how much I dislike that movie.
I would say positive things about The Impossible, in fact. Against you.
You're a known monster.
When a monster calls, you won't Skype to do the podcast. I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with, as alluded to in the tease, Hereafter, a Clint Eastwood film starring Matt Damon as a clairvoyant dude who touches people and tells them about life. Bad.
Is The Impossible the reason why you really don't want to see Spider-Man High School?
The Impossible is actually the reason I don't want to see Hereafter, which is also connected to the Indian Ocean tsunami, I'm realizing.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 133 for Tuesday, August 30th. And yesterday, I got all my facts fucked up, but that's fine because in this two-day span, in 1964, Walt Disney's Mary Poppins came out, directed by Robert Stevenson, starring Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, about to be sequelized. Legacy sequelized, Lega sequelized, as our friend Matt Singer says at Screen Crush, and apparently Julie Andrews has just weighed in. She approves. Mary Poppins Returns is going to be a hit.
You shock me. You shock me, sir.
Hello, Mary Poppins Returns.
Jim Chiru.
Speaking of returns, let's return to this segment that we usually do at the beginning of the show where David types really loud, I guess.
What is happening?
Sorry.
Viciously typing on his computer during the show.
Sorry. It happens. Well, I think it's also on topic, on theme with the theme of tonight's reviews that we'll be reading, which are that I'm the worst, pretty much. And it begins with the typing, although no one cited that in particular. We do have a few iTunes reviews to read for you tonight. And let's start with Sean from Jenny's Block, whose review is called Great Podcast, but who gives us 1 out of 5 stars. And the entire text of his review is David Ehrlich. Then we have Kemloton, who says 2 things and also gives the show 1 star. And says, I only hate 2 things in life. Man's capacity for cruelty towards his fellow man and David Ehrlich. Then we have Shan C, who says, potentially entertaining film podcast dragged down by 1 bad apple. And gives us 3 stars. And we'll give you 1 guess as to who that bad apple is going to be. As the ostensible host, Katie Rich is even-handed, warm, funny, kind, and knowledgeable. It's too bad she often gets crowded out of the discussions by a couple of her boorish counterparts, and, editor's note, a baby. But I like what she has to say when she gets to say it. Dave Seven is a witty, insightful member of the panel and has a measured take on things he likes as well as those he doesn't. I'm fairly neutral on Matt Patches, who occasionally brings up valid points, only to smother them with the verbal eye rolls and talking over the other hosts. But he sounds like a long-lost Marx brother, so at least it's audibly pleasing. When Joanna guests, it's like a ray of sunshine and sanity descended from the heavens. And an ideal lineup would be Katie, Joanna, Dave Seven, with frequent guest Matt. But the albatross around the neck of this whole enterprise is David Ehrlich, who has the personality of an unexpected cancer diagnosis.
Oh my word.
Editor's note. What is an expected cancer diagnosis? Do cancer diagnoses have personalities? But I digress. To call him pretentious would be to give a bad name to bong-huffing junior college philosophy students. I like art films and independent cinema along with my major studio releases, but his small-minded condescension is so off-putting and toxic as to render the entire podcast unlistenable. It would be one thing if his unearned smugness was served with a side of humor or worthy insight, but his head is so far up his own posterior that his colon serves as an expanding universe of his own self-importance. So, three of the four, or four of the five, if you include Joanna, hosts foster good discussion about the week's releases and topics du jour of film, but that one bad apple truly ruins a good bunch. Shame, as the other host deserves better.
Jesus. Okay, I want to go back to the first review, which
have one more really good one, and you're welcome. Finally, Are Your Refrigerators Running? By Brian Colville, who gives us 5 stars. Thank you, Brian. It says, I had a dream last night that I prank called David. Dream David was not amused, so I figured I'd make it up to him by leaving a 5-star review for one of my favorite shows. My one complaint, more review episodes. Well, Brian, once the fall movie season gets into full swing and Katie returns, I think we are all planning.
It's been tough times. Tough times for the reviews.
But, I think
we have to get motivated, but the movies aren't motivating us.
Probably starting in mid-September, we'll return to them.
Okay, now I want to go back to the first review, which is, as I recall, 1 out of 5 stars, great podcast, and then one person saying, who's to say the 1 star is not for the one name, David Ehrlich, and the people found lacking are Dave, Joanna, Katie, and Patrick.
That's true. You might be the saving grace.
You might be the
hopefully,
one star.
Hopefully not. Let's
I will be pray
that
that's turning
not
about
true.
This all night long.
I also think Cancer can be a personality because it is a zodiac sign. I just wanted to bring that up.
But not a diagnosis of cancer. Like, that's... I think it's clear, though, like lowercase cancer here. But that's fine. If I have to be an unexpected cancer diagnosis, that would be like a cool...
You had an upswing of reviews last week. You had a lot of praise. This had to bump you down.
I think it'd be cool to be like an indie cancer, you know? Not like breast cancer or like pancreatic cancer, but like earlobe cancer. Like
this is
cool.
Getting dark.
Yeah. Anyway,
this is getting
this. Earlobe
dark.
Cancer. If you get it, I send it to you. Enjoy.
You would probably be sending it through this podcast, which we hope people do not receive earlobe cancer from and, in fact, receive enjoyment and opinions and fun. And if you get those things, or you don't, leave reviews on iTunes. They always help us climb up
and
the
if
charts.
You're, and if you're a woman listening to this on your headphones, I hope no dude comes up and tries to talk to you.
What is that about? What is this new meme about coming up to women with headphones?
It is sadly not a meme so much as an article that someone was paid to write for
it was modern man something website. It's a nonsense website, and the guy's name is like Dan Bacon or whatever, and it's about like it's a rapey-ish sort of guide on how to approach a woman if she's like wearing headphones and doesn't want to talk to you.
I'm listening to Fighting in the War Room.
Yeah, and well, it's basically like don't take no for an answer. No does not mean no. Keep accosting her until she talks to you. She really wants to talk to you. Like it's if it were a parody, I wouldn't be surprised, but apparently it's not. So
the best way to fight back against any of that is to always be listening to Fighting in the War Room, which would scare away normal people.
There you go.
Who are pursuing you. So if they hear it, they'll just flee. But you, I know you can take it. So keep listening. And we're going to do a bit of a mini show this week because, I don't know, it's Labor Day. We're all very busy. We're preparing for the fall, but we promise it'll be a good time. So let's do it.
Ain't nobody watching.
I feel it fade.
I just fade away.
I feel it.
Fade away.
I feel it. I feel
fade away. Yeah. I think too much.
I feel it.
Who watched the VMAs last night? Anyone watch the VMAs? Actually, it wasn't last night. It was multiple nights ago, depending on when you're listening to this.
I watched every single second of it.
Did you really?
Job. I sure did.
It's been a while since I watched the VMAs. And look, I feel like people are really hard on award shows. We're very cynical about them. There's always something fun happening at an award show because famous people get together. They're loose. They're having a good time. But the VMAs were kind of weak, right?
Yeah.
Were they fun?
No.
What happened?
I think that, well, you know, Beyonce performed 15 minutes, which was freaking incredible, as you, like, yawn, as we expect from her by now. And then poor Britney Spears had to make her come back to the VMAs immediately after Beyonce, which is the cruelest bit of programming I've ever seen in my
Although, to be fair, I spent part of my weekend watching old Britney Spears VMA performances and other award show performances. I don't know if she's ever had a very good time. She can't really dance. She definitely can't sing. She's just kind of this embodiment of a certain moment in pop culture, and I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I wish she wasn't overstaying her welcome, because I know she's a real human being, but...
I mean, she comes from a point in time, and fortunately a point in time that has long since passed, where pop stars really could be more easily manufactured. And I think that as passable as that can still be in certain circumstances, you see it with, like, the One Directions and such, when you put it back to back with, you know, an immense talent of, like, Beyonce's stature, and I think that there were people, you know, I think that, you know, say what you will about what's happening in MTV style music these days, but that Lou Pearlman, like, off the assembly line sort of pop died a long time before Lou Pearlman.
Yeah, I mean, Britney, you know, she had that great one performance with the snake, right? That was good.
Was cool, but it Britney was mostly because it was like a Barbie doll now wearing a snake.
Yeah, and
which is cruel again.
Time where you could just kiss another woman on stage, and it was this huge fucking deal.
Yeah, that was so awkward.
And Perry was like, "No, I'm not going to write a song about that," and now everyone's just like, "Yeah."
Although that. Christina Aguilera was around for that, so that was bolstered by multiple.
But what I'm going to say is that Britney was never going to be great, but I'm just saying if you put her literally anywhere else in the show, she would have looked better than she did immediately following Beyonce. Yeah. You know, there was like cringeworthy Jimmy Fallon doing Ryan Lochte stuff, Jay Farrow stuff was really cringeworthy. Key and Peele stuff was okay, mostly because it got super weird.
It took Rihanna four performances to kind of nail it for me. I thought she was
the last Rihanna performance.
End,
but like, yes.
What the hell?
Well, she wasn't even pretending. Like, she like didn't even have her mic near her mouth while she was dancing. She's like, yeah, you guys know I'm not singing. It's fine. But the last performance was really, really good. So yeah, I would say some bright moments. And of course, Connie was there, but Darren Franich of Entertainment Weekly wrote this great review of the night, and he basically talked about how we still haven't left. I think it's the 2008 VMAs with the Kanye Taylor controversy that we're like stuck in reruns, replaying that every year at the VMAs, and I think that's true.
It's sequel syndrome. It's reboot syndrome. Spreading across everything. Well, let's hone in on Kanye, because that was the most talked about thing that was going to happen at the VMAs. He was going to get 4 minutes to do whatever the hell he wanted, and everyone, I don't know, I had to sit through the red carpet as well last night covering it, so I was listening to people just get excited to see what Kanye was up to.
I feel terrible that I do not have something at my immediate disposal to pour out for you for the Sunday night that you had. Dear Lord.
Both
kiss,
of us.
Kiss your fingers and throw them in a peace sign. Just give me one of those from afar.
I wrote a piece about the best music videos that were nominated for the VMAs last week, but that allowed me to write about, like, in addition to Beyonce, David Bowie and Tame Impala and FKA Twigs, and not just have to deal with whatever the fuck Kanye is serving up.
The best part of the VMAs really was the reel of craft awards that they don't actually let people on stage for anymore, which is sad. But
I watching Kanye West give that speech last night, I felt like that Tyra Banks gif where she's like, you know, we were all rooting for you. Like, I'm so disappointed in Kanye. Like, not only is the life of Pablo ass shit, but, and he knows, he doesn't know it, but I know it, so that's enough for me. And the weakest album of his career by a fair sight. But he's completely regurgitating his own insanity at this point.
Well, that's what I really want to...
It's so tired. Yeah. It's so empty. And the fact that a generation of people and his peers want to goad him along as he climbs even further up his own asshole is really disheartening to watch.
Well, I wanted to ask you guys about Kanye as the artist, because I feel like he was lauded for being the standout from the commerce of the music business, and he was pure. He really was the second coming of Steve Jobs or Walt Disney or something, and that he was going to carve this persona out in the hip hop world or in the music world. And, you know, maybe that was 2 years ago, and now 2 years later, he's the one, as you mentioned, saying this. So in his speech, just to kind of reiterate for people who may have missed it, he starts, the whole speech is mostly about his music video Famous, which everyone saw on the internet. And he says, man, the audacity to put Anna Wintour right next to Donald Trump. I mean, I put Ray J in it, bro. That's fame, bro. And then he keeps going on and he's like, talking about Kim Kardashian and kind of the amazing job he did. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he even says, you know, my role models are artists. There's less than 10 I can name in history. Truman, Ford, Hughes, Disney, Jobs, and West. He is the one who starts putting himself in the pantheon. I think that's so interesting.
How many times have you watched this today?
How many times did I watch it?
Yeah.
No, well, no,
I actually wrote
it
down.
Right?
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The beautiful thing about notes is I don't have to memorize Kanye West.
I thought you pulled that right, you know, from memory of watching it. I was impressed. Yeah, but I think that, I mean, maybe I'm misremembering, but I always saw him as the second coming of Jay-Z, not the second coming of Steve Jobs. He always saw himself that way, and I never really bought it. And I find his message more and more hollow as he goes along.
But he does have grander aspirations than the music.
Well, sure he does, but none of them feel real to me. But I do think that, I'm hardly alone in thinking this, that given our current climate, it is unavoidable to compare somebody going up there ranting extemporaneously in front of a nationally televised audience, not thinking of Donald Trump. And I, you know,
not,
of course,
not
also,
Henry Ford. You weren't reminded of Henry Ford?
No, I was not reminded of Henry Ford. Oh.
You don't remember that great speech Henry Ford gave at the VMAs in 1922?
About Taylor Swift? No. Okay.
I forget.
So much shade.
And of course, you know, with the promise of running for office and for president in 2020, you know, is Kanye West a better person than Donald Trump? Yeah, that's a low bar. But if you ever were to sit there and imagine a Democrat Donald Trump, Kanye West is the image that comes to mind.
Well, Joanna, what do you think of him as a director? Because that's what I really wanted to get into, because last night he also showed the video for Fade. Am I correct?
Yeah, I really liked the video for Fade. Weirdly.
Really?
I was like mesmerized by it. I don't know what to tell you. I thought, you know, it's just basically like this stripped down, very sweaty, beautiful dancer. Her name's Tiana, and I forget her last name.
Taylor.
And then, you know, there's like sexy shower times, and then she's like a cat lady with her real life NBA husband, I think, and her baby.
She had a baby 8 months ago. Can you believe it? I cannot.
I surely cannot. But I don't know. It didn't tell me anything artistically, but I was like, I don't know if I was trained by watching too many 80s movies or Flashdance too many times, but I was just sort of into watching her dance. I thought it was really mesmerizing.
It changed the game. This video changed the game forever.
Maybe
the game, the rapper.
Maybe it changed my sexuality.
Well, what about compared to Famous? Do you see some sort of, do you see talent behind the camera? That was kind of my end goal here. Is Kanye West a director?
Not really. I mean, Famous made no impact on me, and maybe I'm just so lowbrow that I thought Fade was more interesting than Famous. But when you compare it to what Beyonce put up out there, which, you know, why not? If we're going to compare Britney to Beyonce, let's compare Kanye to Beyonce. Beyonce, of course, didn't direct Lemonade, but when you compare it to the visual brilliance and just like extreme impact.
I thought Beyonce did direct segments of Lemonade, or she's crazy.
It's hard to know.
She's the visionary. She's the visionary behind it.
But at that point, you're sort of splitting hairs. But I think that
A director. When she took the award, she thanked a director and for her vision, I think. So anyway, regardless. I mean, Beyonce probably did everything. Beyonce, like, did all the hair and all the costumes and everything.
She just
that
points
happened.
At
but,
things
like,
and they manifest in front of her.
Let's not forget that Runaway is fucking awesome. Let that be said.
Okay.
In Kanye's defense, it's the biggest video project that he's ever undertaken, and it is.
He didn't direct that.
I believe. I mean,
while David is While David is furiously Googling, here's my question for you, Patches, then. Would you be excited for a Kanye West feature film?
I would be. I would be excited to see what he thinks he needs 90 minutes to do. But I would be a little worried that it would be like a faux art project and not really, you know, be coherent or even have an artistic point to truly make. Because I see Kanye, you know, I was watching some of his videos. I was watching Flashing Lights from 2007, which is just this, you know, like scantily clad woman walking through the desert, gritty desert. Feels very Grindhouse. And I was like, wait, when did the movie Grindhouse come out? Oh, yeah, that was 2007.
Like 10-year streak of never once being wrong on this podcast, Kanye West did in fact direct Runaway, and he, and I'm quoting the Wikipedia here, drew inspiration rather from director Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, there you
of
go. Yeah,
he did.
So he just feels very. I don't see his vision in anything. I see him as a very reflective artist, and you know
he's like the Stranger Things of directors.
He's more like the Robert Rodriguez of hip hop, I think. Okay. I mean, but I have to give him credit. He worked with Bill Plimpton on the Heard Him Say video, and you know he does interesting visual stuff. But I made a joke earlier today about how I hope that Kanye gets out of his Matthew Barney phase, because that's exactly what I think Fate is. It's just this kind of creme master obsession and faux artistic, you know, authority.
Creme,
I don't really,
creme
I don't get
this. Maybe
what was that?
Creme apprentice.
Yeah.
I think that he certainly has an artistic curiosity. He certainly has the resources and the chutzpah, thank you, required to reach out to these people and ape a lot of their styles. You know, I think the Jodorowsky influence is obvious. I know he's an avowed fan.
Oh, sure.
And some of this stuff, you know, Flashdance, rather, is obviously the backdrop for Fate video and so on. But I don't know if he has the fully developed visual identity, at least for his video work, as he does in his in the identity of his songwriting.
So we await the Kanye feature film. I really wanted to see Kanye. He was going to do an HBO show with Larry Charles, like a sketch comedy or kind of like a punked show. I have no idea what it was going to be, but I wanted to see that.
But somebody to make a movie. I mean, there are plenty of exceptions to this rule, but somebody needs to be there to say no, or at least think about it. And
the man's a god.
Kanye has that person.
No. Kanye, you couldn't save the VMAs this year, but maybe next year. We'll see what's
ratings
next.
Ratings were down. Ratings were down. Huge. Sad.
Blame Kanye. Huge.
It is Monday evening, and Gene Wilder passed away today, Monday, August 29th. And, you know, he's one of those big, quote-unquote, deaths that a lot of people feel the need to mourn sort of publicly. I think we've talked on here about public mourning, but
wait,
since...
Hey, I'm still laughing at the quote-unquote
death. Quote-unquote death.
Are you suggesting that he's not actually dead?
Did I say quote-unquote dead?
You did.
Quote-unquote oh, dear. Death. Jeez. All right. Gene Wilder is for sure dead, unless he's not. He's alive.
With Tupac and Elvis.
Yep.
On another planet.
Sorry, it's been a long day. But something that we don't have to talk about this too much, but something that I have thought about since the last time we talked about publicly mourning a death was Chuck Klosterman was on, I think it was Marin. I forget which podcast it was. And he was talking about how, since the monoculture is becoming so fractured, so scarce, one of the few things that we have, a shared emotional experience that we all have, are these like celebrity deaths. that we can all have this emotional catharsis, you know, in front of our computers at work, and we put something on Twitter and we see what someone else put on Twitter, and we put something on Facebook and whatever. And some people look down their nose at it. And for some people, it's really an important part of letting go of this celebrity. But I was just thinking about that today with Gene Wilder. I mean, I think it's a really fine point that Chuck Klosterman makes. Since we have so few things that we all watch together, this has weirdly become one of them. And so Gene Wilder, who wasn't, you know, the most important actor to ever come across my life, but, you know, as a good child of the 80s, I was a huge fan of his comedies. And I don't know, do you guys have any thoughts, anything that cropped up in your mind today thinking about the passing of Gene Wilder?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about Blazing Saddles as we scrutinize jokes and figure out what's problematic and what's not. I often think about Blazing Saddles as kind of this pillar of it was racy then, it was racy now, and I don't mean racy as a pun for race jokes, although there are many of them in Blazing Saddles. I mean, it's just this confluence of fart jokes and musical humor and wordplay and like just dazzling performances from Gene Wilder and Cleveland Little, who plays Bart, the sheriff. And the two of them, I was watching scenes of that today, just the rapport that they have, why comedy, this comedy prevails, is so much more than the quotable lines or the memorable scenes that you can replay on YouTube. It's really just about this friendship that they forge throughout the movie. And I think that's what Gene Wilder did so well, and why I've just felt this like longing for him. I was just thinking about him the other day, speaking of Marc Maron podcasts, not Marc Maron podcasts. I was reading about Shock Jocks the other day. It's very strange. But I was, now I'm forgetting his wife's name.
Gilda Radner.
Gilda Radner. Gilda Radner did a Howard Stern interview once where they were just pressing her on Gene Wilder and just like an amazing husband Gene Wilder was. And I was just thinking about him lately, like, why didn't he do movies in the last 20, almost 30 years of his life? He really did not act much after he had a 90s sitcom, and that didn't really go anywhere. And then he did maybe two or three roles and just nothing. And I thought, like, Gene Wilder, amazing voice and amazing character. Where did he go? And then I was watching interviews of him at the 92nd Y on YouTube, and I would highly recommend watching this interview. I just thought it was fantastic. It was from 3 years ago, and he just digs into it. He's like, why did I not make movies? Because there were not good movies to make, and I didn't feel like being in a movie that was in 3D, and I didn't feel like being in a movie that had explosions, and I didn't want to be in a movie where everyone was saying fuck all the time. It was just the sweetest thing. He's been writing novels for the past few years.
Yeah, he writes mystery novels.
Yeah, I just thought it was the sweetest thing, and that tenor that he had, I don't know, it carried through all of his movies.
Have those novels been published? Are they widely available?
Oh, they're totally available, yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty, I mean, they're procedurals, but they're pretty popular, and I think they did an A&E TV series out of them.
Oh, whoa.
Actually.
I never had a particularly a strong attachment to Gene Wilder. I'm a fan of Mel Brooks, but the Mel Brooks movie that was always closest to my heart was, for personal reasons at least, was History of the World Part 1, in which Gene Wilder does not appear. But I found myself appreciating more in the obvious titles some of the lesser movies that Gene Wilder did, because those were the ones that always seemed to be on cable when I was growing up. Like See No Evil, Hear No Evil, which is not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination, which he plays a deaf man paired with Richard Pryor playing a blind man. It is something, but I always found it sort of endearing because you could tell that it was bad, and you could tell that he was a genius, and a genius stuck in a bad movie is always interesting in its own way. So films like that I always appreciated him for, but...
I think you get the sense from him, like what you said, Patches, about him not really making any, he didn't make any films after 1991. Gilda Radner passed away, I believe, in 89. And, it's sort of like with Rick Moranis, it's one of those things where you really feel like this person's life stopped in a very demonstrable way when they lost their spouse. I mean, he married again. It's not like he withered up and went away, but like that something very, very important just stopped for him. And when you see performers, you know, comedians especially, who are usually so thirsty for a laugh over anything else. But when you see them just sort of press pause onto something because of personal loss, that's just like one of those sad clown things, which is something that Gene Wilder always did to perfection. So, I mean, rest in peace, man. That's a really trite way to end that sentence. Sorry.
Now
make
you can
him
sing.
Laugh in hell, Gene. There you go. Summer, the BBC polled, it was like 173 critics, maybe even more, from across the world on the, to pick their 10 favorite films of the millennium thus far. And they drew the cutoff, and the semantics are up in the air. But for the purposes of this particular poll, the millennium started on January 1st, 2000. And the results were not necessarily unpredictable. And Mulholland Drive topped the list. There are films like Yee Yee and There'll Be Blood and Boyhood, and I wrote the capsule for Lost in Translation, which was my number one and came in at number 22 or something like that, 24 somewhere. It was a bit interesting, but I think, you know, we want to talk tonight about the larger takeaways that we have from it, and just to get the ball rolling. And we'll put the link to this in the show notes if you haven't already seen it. The BBC themselves provided a handful of really interesting facts about the makeup of the people who were polled, the makeup of the gender divide between male and female of who directed the films, in addition to who voted for them, what years most films came from, where they premiered, and so on. I think that when you have two things that I found really interesting were, one, for the most part, the absence of comedies. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I think that a lot of that is owed to the fact that when you are talking about the best films of a particular era in time, particularly for as long a period of time as the last 16 years, there's a certain weight to that, a certain immensity to what you're talking about. You think about less the films that you had a good laugh in the theater or find relaxing and comforting to watch on cable on Saturday mornings or Friday nights, but more the films that really had a weight on you that sort of, you know, had that.
Which great comedies can have. I think when we talk about Gene Wilder, that's where we're talking about his movies having that weight and being really
funny.
Yeah,
but
when we talk about Gene Wilder.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that they don't have that weight. I'm simply saying that when you ask someone to name what to their mind are the greatest films of a particular time, that quality does not have the same heft.
I don't buy that.
I don't want to besmirch you, David Ehrlich, because I know you participated in this poll.
And I would argue that my number one film,
Matt Patches, nor any of our dear beloved friends.
And I would argue that Lost in Translation, which was atop my ballot, is a comedy.
But I will say, I want to say that I feel like if I were blessed to be asked to do this poll, I would feel the need to impress people a little bit with my picks. And so I think you might see a little skewing. I'm not accusing you guys of the other 100 something critics or whatever, a little skewing of someone who's like, I want to have, because, you know, the individual lists were published as well. I want to have a really impressive list. Not that an impressive list is a dishonest list, but all I'll say is I give mad props to our girl Katie Rich, because I feel like she had a real role. Katie Rich list up there. Not that you guys didn't, but
I definitely did not have a Katie Rich list. I'll say that.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't feel like the embarrassment of someone looking at my list and wanting to impress people. I do feel the weight of choosing and being true to myself. I feel like that is the scarier thing. Missing something that I really cared about and not representing it fairly, and just kind of gravitating towards bigger movies. So I guess there is something there. I do feel a pressure, but it's not based on what other people think.
How long did you guys have to decide?
Oh, we had a long time.
I will be completely honest, I picked my list in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, so like, Joanna, we had, I think, upwards of a week to submit our ballot. I think that patched experience is probably pretty common. I also took fewer than 10 minutes to cobble my list together. I did not think about it all that hard, but I didn't really have to. I mean, and I didn't really sweat the order. I mean, a lot of people were like, how was Carol not number one? It was slighted at number two.
Rooney Mara herself sending you messages.
I wanted to be true to my picks, to true to myself with my picks, but I also wanted to I was definitely conscious whenever you make a list like this or submit to a list like this of being a voice for certain things. And so not only did I have Don Hertzfeldt's World of Tomorrow, which is a short on my list, and I think anyone who's listened to the show knows me.
I was about to say, you have to be true to years of podcasting about what you prefer.
Yeah,
that would be the greatest embarrassment.
That wasn't much of a stretch for me to consider that one of the 10 best films of any kind over the last 16 years. But I also put Girl Walk All Day as number 10 because, in addition to my very deep and sincere love for that movie, I thought that it was, given what has happened to our culture and the digital revolution over the last decade and change, it was important to give a voice to a product of that culture, to talk about the intermingling between music video and film, talk about using sort of on the fly, on the street video, often surreptitiously filmed, in ways that are edited together as content for people. And I think there were a lot of factors that felt like that was an appropriate pick for a list that reflected these particular 16 years. And that almost certainly gave it an edge for me over movies that are also incredible that I would have loved to have put in that 10th slot. And I would have loved to have featured, and I do feel like a real guilt for leaving out some of the funniest comedies of my lifetime, like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Step Brothers and Forgetting Sarah Marshall, but so it goes.
I had Borat on my list. I just want to say that. I also had Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think fits. It hit me hard, but I was laughing the entire time. That is a comedy. That's a hilarious movie.
It is a comedy. Okay, so my other question to you guys is, this is so funny, because if you listen to another Katie Rich podcast, Little Gold Men, I basically was on that episode with two guys who had done the list in interviewing them about it. So,
we can flip this on you. Just
No. I have nothing to say. I wasn't part of it.
Why did you not come away with a top 10 after talking to Little Gold Men about
this?
You do not have
Almost Famous. Number two, episodes 1-9 of Roadies.
Nailed it. No,
number
okay. So my question was, how far down the top 100 do you have to get before you hit a movie that you have not seen?
That I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm. Or have you seen them all?
I had seen them all except for one, and kudos to anyone out there. If you want to pause the podcast right now, look at the list, and take a guess as to which one of those movies it is that I have not seen. I'll give you a hint. It was, not because it was eluded my attention, but simply because I decided that I was better than it. which is probably wrong. I hear it's wonderful and clearly it's good enough that it made the list, but I just, from everything that I'd read about The Secret in Their Eyes, the original, not the remake, I decided that life is just too short.
I have not seen Timbuktu.
Oh, it's so good.
Number 36 on the list. Yes, it's been sitting on my list, as it's formally called, for ages. I should probably catch up with that. Well, Joanna, number one, what about you? And then two, I also want to know what surprised you. Like, broken to the top.
You don't have to get far to hit a movie I haven't seen, which is Yee Yee, which I will rectify. Don't worry, I'll rectify. It's fine. And what broke into the top that I'm surprised by? I guess I would say Pan's Labyrinth, because I thought that movie got, like, you know, acclaim when it came out, and I thought the narrative later shifted to, Guillermo del Toro, we hate everything, blah, Pan's Labyrinth. So I was surprised to see people.
I have to say that the survey.
Yeah, I think you've just been talking to me too much.
Yeah, well, I have to say that the surveyed critics, it's a pretty broad spectrum from around the world of,
right, you know,
there
are international
people in Korea, there are people in African countries, there are people, you know, all over the place, well represented, and men and women. So I thought it was interesting that we still kind of ended up with the Pillars, some obvious choices in the top 10, the top 20, but do you think it's interesting that there are movies from 2015 on this list, or 2014? I'm shocked. Yeah,
there's a movie from 2016 on the list, number 100.
Right.
Tony Guzman.
Coming soon.
I was looking at Spotlight, which is a movie that I absolutely loved. I love Spotlight, but I will be very curious if we did this survey in 10 years' time, if it would. It has the 88 spot, and I'm just wondering if it would still be up there, or if people are just like, oh, when not thoughtlessly, oh, that won Best Picture last year, but it's still fresh in their brains, you know. So Carol, of course, will always be at number 69 on the list, and number nice. 2 and David Ehrlich, sorry.
Yeah, I wonder if I had put it on number 1, because, you know, a lot of these movies were only voted on by like 4 or 5 people. Lost in Translation was number 22 or 24, whatever it was, and I was one of 2 people who had it at number 1. So clearly a number 1 vote went a long way. I wonder if I had put Carol number 1, how much higher it would have climbed.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great list. It's a great. I think you're right that it skews like, you know, American or Western, but there's a great spread of foreign films, and I'm hoping that the use of a list like this is to shame people like me into seeing Yi Yi or other films that they haven't
seen.
No, not shame, but just sort of like encourage, you know, just be like, oh man, you know, so many of my peers think that this is one of the best movies ever, and I somehow slip. Like, let me watch it.
People can grouse about this list and generate arguments and think pieces all they want. If one person, particularly if that person is Joanna Robinson, goes and watches, like sits down, turns off the lights, turns off their phone, and watches all 3 hours of Yi Yi because of its justifiably incredibly high position on this list.
Wait, can you talk? Can you dig in for 1 second about Yi Yi? Because I think it is the highest ranked on your list that ends up highly ranked on the top list. So what is it about Yi Yi?
Yi Yi is Edward Yang's final film. Edward Yang died in his mid-50s, tragically, after making films like The Terrorizers and A Brighter Summer Day and That Day on the Beach. And Yi Yi is a 3-hour film that's essentially about, I think it takes place over the course of a year, I want to say, maybe less. It spans from a funeral to a wedding, I believe, in the life of a family in Taiwan. It's a very simple film. The comparisons to Ozu sort of make themselves, but it has some melodramatic flair in there. But it really is one of those movies that, in its own tender, graceful, unforgettable way, packs in so much of what life has to offer. There's this one protracted sequence in which the father of the sort of like a patriarch of the family that we see here, who's the father of the little boy, whose name is also I can't remember if his name is Yi, which means sort of translates to a 1 and a 2. He's the little kid you see on the cover who's always taking pictures of the people of the back of people's heads in order to show them what they can't see for themselves, which is, you know, an obvious expression of, I think, what a lot of Edward Yang's films are capable of doing for their viewers. But there's this long sequence in which the little kid's father goes to Japan with an old flame. And it's just it's like a little Richard Linklater movie packed into this bigger movie. It's just so beautiful. The whole thing is so coherent and flows immaculately, really, from start to finish. There are few more comforting, honest movies that you will ever see. It's the kind of thing that once you watch once, you will put on regularly for the rest of your life, just to sort of center yourself. So highly recommended.
All right.
Well, that's the BBC list. Actually, wait, one more question for you guys. There's only one Spielberg movie on this list. Does that one shock you, two confuse you? It's AI. Of all things,
well,
and I'm curious if that's.
I like AI.
Oh no, I love AI.
I mean, Catch Me If You Can is one of my
I agree.
Favorite movies. I don't know why.
That's what I regret not putting on my list.
Yeah.
Catch Me If You Can specifically?
Yeah, I love it.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm just struggling to think of like.
Coming to my house and telling me that Catch Me If You Can is not a masterpiece, Joanna.
But I'm just trying to think of like what else he's made in the past 16
Lincoln
years
would,
that I would.
Even Lincoln would be above AI for me, and I'm saying this as someone who loves David the asparagus eating robot. Spinach, sorry.
I was hoping that you would say loves David the right-minded person who thinks that AI is a much better movie than Lincoln.
The Orga. But,
Catch Me If You Can absolutely should have been on this list and quite high. It should have been on my list. I take a certain degree of responsibility for it not being there.
You should.
But yeah, I mean, I think that Spielberg's, even though he's
so not the Terminal.
Not the Terminal.
Not Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Not The Adventures of Tintin.
The Adventures of Tintin is on my top 25 of the year. I wrote one of the only positive reviews you will ever read of The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. You know, I think even with your War Horses and your BFGs and your Terminals, Spielberg is more hit than miss for me in this millennium. But Catch Me If You Can is so far and ahead, so far and away ahead of the rest of the pack that it's really absurd that it's not there.
I think his star is just so diminished comparatively. And that, I mean, that being said, of course, Catch Me If You Can, Lincoln, these are great movies. No, but like compared, like the last 16 years compared to the first, you know, however, 20, 30 years of his career.
I don't know. I love like 1998 to 2005 Steven Spielberg. War of the Worlds is a pretty damn good movie.
Into my home, she comes and says that Catch Me If You Can is not up to snuff. With earlier Spielberg, I mean, will the microaggressions never cease?
Wait, so Joanna, is there one movie missing from the list to wrap up for you?
That I would put on there? I mean, no, of course not. Almost Famous is on there, so we're good. We're all good. Let's see. I guess, did The Royal Tenenbaums make it? I know other Wes Anderson
did. It did.
Okay, then we're good. I'm good.
You're represented.
Yes, I'm represented. Royal Tenenbaums, Almost Famous, all your white ennui. I'm here. I'm good.
That's the problem with this list, but also, I don't know. There's so many problems, and it gets so much right. So I guess that's the BBC list, and never look back.
I shoot the lights out until it's bright out. Oh, just another lonely night. Are you willing to sacrifice your life?
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back after Labor Day at some point to get back into the swing of things with more episodes, hopefully more reviews of movies we want to confront, challenge ourselves with. I don't know. August, it was a dry spell. I'm sorry. We were busy. We went on vacation. No, we didn't.
And maybe. Katie Rich.
It's, we can't announce it. No spoilers.
Maybe.
Someone might get the scoop.
Katie Rich.
Charlie Baltus will be joining us as the next generation of Fighting the Worm. Why don't we tell people where they can find us on the internet, starting with David.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter with David Ehrlich. You can find me in Colorado at the Telluride Film Festival later this week. Yeah, I'm going to be there.
Bring your oxygen.
My oxygen. And you can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can find me talking about Hamilton this week with Dave Gonzalez and Neil Miller over on Storm of Spoilers. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Joe Lopez.
And I am Matt Patches. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. And you can find us on Twitter at FITWR, where you can answer this week's lightning round question, which is in honor of The Light Between Oceans by Derek Cianfrance. What's the worst Oscar-ready movie you've ever seen? That's it, and we'll be back next week. My presence is a present. Kiss my ass. Gossip.